At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
We're going to go back to the main story of the morning now, which we've also had a lot of calls on and a lot of comments. The summit in Alaska and what, if anything, it adds up to. And we're going to talk to LBC's Washington correspondent, Simon Marks, who joins us now. Hello, Simon.
Hello, Clive.
Have we got any fresh comments since that so-called press conference? Do we know any more at this stage?
Well, only a bit. I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, it wasn't really a joint press conference. It was the two leaders making statements to the assembled reporters and then taking no questions and basically stalking off the stage and heading to their respective aeroplanes and leaving Anchorage pretty much as quickly as they could. And I think that really gives you a sense of just how little progress was made at this summit. The Russians are absolutely projecting this as a huge win for them. And I think if you've seen the images of Vladimir Putin being welcomed at the airport by an applauding Donald Trump, then clambering into the back of the beast, the president's armored limousine, smiling, grinning like a Cheshire cat as the beast conveyed him to the summit venue. I mean, the Russians definitely think that the mere fact that Vladimir Putin, a man sanctioned to the hilt by the United States, wanted for war crimes in Ukraine by the International Criminal Court, the mere fact that he was able to set foot on American soil, even more so go to an American military base in Alaska, was a huge win for him. As you know, President Trump says they agreed on many points, but there were still some significant items on which they disagreed. He said that one of those was a very significant disagreement. He was not able, as you know, to announce any kind of breakthrough, any kind of truce or ceasefire, any kind of plan to invite Volodymyr Zelensky to a wider meeting that he would be brought into, as the American president had indicated all week long that he coveted. He has now, Donald Trump, given an interview to Sean Hannity of the Fox News Channel, and Mr. Hannity, one of his most prominent public supporters, pressed him to reveal what the big disagreement was all about.
In your press conference, you talked about a lot of things that you agreed on, and maybe one big issue you don't agree on. Are you prepared to go public with that?
No, I'd rather not. I guess somebody's going to go public with it. They'll figure it out. But no, I don't want to do that. I want to see if we can get it done. You know, it's not a done deal at all. Mm-hmm. And Ukraine has to agree. I mean, you know, President Zelensky has to agree. But it's a terrible war where he's losing a lot, and both of them are. And hopefully it can get completed. That'd be a great achievement for them. Forget about me.
That's President Trump talking to Sean Hannity of Fox News after the press appearance and before he flew out of Anchorage aboard Air Force One. He's now heading back to the United States. It's another roughly 7-hour plane ride here. I have to say, he looked pretty exhausted by the time the talks ended. And I do think that one has to wonder if the strategy of having Donald Trump wake up at dawn here in Washington, fly 7 hours to Anchorage, go straight into those meetings with Vladimir Putin, get pretty much nowhere, and then fly all the way back another 7 hours to Washington, D.C., was a particularly sensible strategy, given that he could actually have flown to Alaska 24 hours earlier and acclimatized himself and spent some time preparing to meet Vladimir Putin and doing what former presidents would normally have done, you know, get their noses into the briefing books, surround themselves with their national security advisors. Of course, that's not the way he's done it. He spent the entire week talking about this summit rather than planning for it. And now he's exhausted himself and is coming back essentially with nothing to show for it. And it's going to be interesting to see how the White House spins all of this. You heard him there say to Sean Hannity that he still wants to get this done. But that big stumbling block, I mean, there's only two real possibilities. It's either President Putin's steadfast refusal to entertain the idea of any kind of conversation with Volodymyr Zelensky, or his steadfast refusal to embrace the idea even of a 30-day truce in the conflict, or possibly both. But interesting that Donald Trump didn't want to reveal it. I mean, the normally very talkative American president has tonight been very reticent.
Yeah, I think those are two good guesses as to what the big sticking point might be. And it just makes me wonder whether it could... I mean, if those two can't agree, then there's no point in taking it to anywhere else, is there? I mean, he was talking about, oh, I'll have to see what Zelensky says. But if they haven't agreed, then there's no point in taking it to anyone else or making any phone calls, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's evident from what Vladimir Putin had to say at that press appearance that he, the Russian leader, didn't move an inch in these talks. Take a listen to what he said about the prospects for advancing some kind of conversation about a ceasefire or ultimate peace negotiation in Ukraine.
The situation in Ukraine has to do with fundamental threats to our security. To make the settlement lasting and long-term, we need to eliminate all the primary causes of that conflict.
Now, when he talks there about the primary causes, that is code. He was speaking there, of course, through a translator. That is code, the phrase that the Russians always use when they basically want to push back at the whole idea of Ukrainian independence and the existence of a sovereign Ukraine. You know, Vladimir Putin has written long articles about this, criticizing Joseph Stalin and leaders in the Soviet Union for imbuing Ukraine, which, of course, was a constituent republic of the Soviet Union, with the concept that somehow it enjoyed some degree of sovereignty. He rejects that whole concept wholesale. He also, when he talks about root causes, is talking about pushing NATO forces back from Europe's borders with Russia. So he's been saying that ever since the conflict began, and there was no evidence in that press conference that Donald Trump had broken him down on any of that. He's absolutely still sticking to it, but equally waxed lyrical about the prospects for economic cooperation between the United States and Russia, saying it was time for the two countries to turn the page and take advantage of the opportunities that existed economically without giving Donald Trump anything in return on the issue of Ukraine.
Do you think Putin really does want to rebuild the Soviet Union and build this massive empire?
No, I don't think he wants to rebuild the Soviet Union, Clive, because he is critical of the Soviet Union and the way in which it was constructed, because it did, and it was always a pastiche, but it did officially recognize a degree of independence of all of these independent entities, places like Ukraine, places like Georgia, the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. So what I think Vladimir Putin is a Russian nationalist who wants Russia to expand its empire and, in the case of Ukraine, absolutely flatten this notion that Ukraine somehow enjoys any right to any degree of independence. And he feels exactly the same way about Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia as well, and possibly also Georgia, Moldova and some of the other sovereign nations that were formerly members of the Soviet Union. So I think we often, in the West, we think he's trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. Actually, what he's trying to do is create a new Russian empire, absolutely dominated by Russian nationalism and the Russian Orthodox Church. So he's definitely into the whole concept of territorial expansionism, but he doesn't want to make what he thinks are the mistakes that Lenin, Stalin and subsequent Soviet leaders made in suggesting to these kind of far-off outposts that actually they really did enjoy some kind of sovereignty and an ability to govern their own affairs.
Did you notice Putin saying that line about how there would have been no war under Trump? And he sort of wanted to say, well, I know Trump has said this. Well, it's actually true.
Yes, and of course, well, they've seized upon that. In fact, Donald Trump has seized upon it in his interview with Sean Hannity tonight, saying that he was delighted to hear Vladimir Putin say it. But, I mean, that is Vladimir Putin absolutely playing Donald Trump like a violin. And that's why, because Donald Trump, of course, has repeated this again and again and again like a mantra. If I had been president, there would never have been a war on Ukraine. There's no evidence to support that view beyond the fact that Trump insiders insist that, Vladimir Putin would have been quaking in his boots about the possible reaction from Donald Trump. But the more Donald Trump has talked over the last week, the more evident I think it's become that he's provided the Russians with vast amounts of ammunition. If you pore over the comments that he's been making, whether it's in those impromptu press appearances at the White House, at the Kennedy Center earlier in the week, or the interviews that he's given, the 40-minute interview just yesterday to Fox News Radio, you've given everything away. You've given the Russians everything they need to know about your approach to the summit. And in the case of Vladimir Putin, he's been dealing with every single American president since Bill Clinton, and he believes he's eaten every single one of them for breakfast. Sergei Lavrov, the veteran Russian foreign minister, was so confident about this meeting today that he showed up in Anchorage wearing a sweatshirt, and he must have known this was he was going to have pictures taken of him wearing this sweatshirt that said CCCP, which of course is in Cyrillic, the abbreviation for the USSR. So, I mean, Sergei Lavrov was kind of, I mean, they might have well have been playing the Beatles singing Back in the USSR as a soundtrack to it. So they came in supremely confident that they were going to own Trump and his entourage at this summit, and they're going home convinced that they did it.
And what have the Democrats been saying about this? They never seem to be very prominent, but have they been kicking back on all of this, or do they just let Trump play out his whole circus?
Largely, I'm bound to say, I've heard very little from Democrats about this summit other than concern that they were expressing that Donald Trump was about to sell Ukraine down the river. Whether they now seek to capitalize on what appears to be a lack of tremendous success at this summit, we'll have to see. I think that more broadly, Democrats here are absolutely struggling to get any attention. If you look at what's happened in the last week, Donald Trump, literally a week ago at this time, we'd only just discovered that the summit was taking place in Alaska. So that sucked up all the oxygen in the room over the last week. And then beyond that, he's, of course, deployed the National Guard here in Washington, D.C., inventing a crime wave largely out of thin air here as a pretext for deploying troops on the streets. He says he's going to do it in Los Angeles, in New York, in Chicago, in cities all over the country. He's also this week announced that every single exhibit on display in the world-famous Smithsonian Institution museums that lie in the heart of Washington, D.C., they're all going to be audited. And every exhibit is going to be audited to see whether it aligns with President Trump's interpretation of history. And if it doesn't, it might find itself back in the stockroom. So that's been going on. And Donald Trump, of course, has been calling he's been announcing the honorees for this year's Kennedy Center Awards, calling it the Trump Kennedy Center because he's now the boss of the Kennedy Center. So you've had all of these things in the last week, all of them designed to divert everyone's attention away from Trump's difficulties with Jeffrey Epstein. And they don't only do that, but they also create even more trouble for Democrats who just can't break through. They just can't grab the Klieg light of publicity because Donald Trump once again is a master, after this failed summit in Alaska, he's a master at getting everybody to change the subject and soaking up all the oxygen that's out there.
Yeah, well, they need to get their act together. And is it because they don't have a figurehead? Because Joe Biden is really gone now, but there's nobody there to represent them?
Yes. I mean, they're in a real mess, Clive. Look, part of this is sort of constitutional. There is no leader of the opposition here. So once a party loses an election, it usually takes a couple of years to figure out where it's going to find its next standard bearer. But it's usually not doing that in an environment in which democracy is being demonstrably rolled back and threatened every single day by the incumbent president of the United States. So the Democrats have kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, what can we do? We've got to go away and lick our wounds, and we've got to go through the process of figuring out, you know, where the next generation of leaders are here. And you've got the old guard like Nancy Pelosi, the Bidens, even the Obamas, really pushing back at this notion that there necessarily needs to be generational change. Certainly, they don't particularly fancy the generational change that is represented by Zoran Mamdani, the Democrat who looks like he's going to become the next New York City mayor, because he's a democratic socialist from the left of the country. But the real issue they face is that they appear irrelevant to Americans. The Democratic Party's popularity, its approval rating with American voters, is at its lowest ebb, I think, for over 30 years. 33% of American voters say they approve of the Democrats and the role they're currently playing, and they just don't seem to be able to find a voice that can reflect the urgency of the moment as it is viewed by millions and millions of their grassroots supporters all over the country. So there is a real struggle within the party and a real struggle by the party to try and persuade Americans that they know what they're doing, and that they've got some kind of an answer to the crisis that their own voters feel the country is now in.
Just one other thing. What did you make of that final comment? Next time in Moscow.
That was absolutely fantastic. So Donald Trump basically said at the end of the press conference, Vladimir, thanks very much for coming. I hope I'll see you again soon. And then Vladimir Putin, in English, and by the way, he speaks more than passable English, he said, well, next time in Moscow, of course. And Donald Trump really, I think, for a moment there, absolutely sensed that there was a trap. And he responded by saying, oh, that's an interesting one. I don't know. I'd get a little bit of heat on that, but then he kind of pauses. He doesn't shut the door totally. He pauses and he says, well, I could see it possibly happening. So even that, you know, even at the last minute, Putin there was trying to lure Trump in, and Trump wasn't quite sure whether he could take the bait or not.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Simon Marks joining us there, LBC's Washington correspondent.